Hi, welcome to Lights, Camera, Author. I'm Jim Juno, and of course, this is a show where we talk with authors who write books about show business. And for those regular viewers, you may notice a little bit different background. My home office is being upgraded, so I am displaced here. But I've got a real interesting gentleman today. His name is Patrick Humphreys, and his new book is now out. It's called Cleopatra, the Undoing of Hollywood: How One Film Almost Sunk the Studios. Patrick, welcome to Lights, Camera, Author.
Hi, hi.
Now, Cleopatra, this is not, now this is, let viewers know, this is not the original silent movie, but the 1963 movie starring Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton. And I was reading your book, and I'm telling you what, I'm amazed that this movie even got made.
It's a miracle. For all the wrong reasons. Yes, it you're absolutely right. There had been earlier Cleopatras. And of course we're looking back now to 1963 when it premiered, but it began years before then. And the original plan was for a $2 million vehicle cashing in on the biblical craze that the 50s had. I mean, Ben-Hur particularly, big screen entertainment that you couldn't get at home. Contract player Joan Collins was lined up for Cleopatra to play the title role. And they went to it, it began because the studio, 20th Century Fox, went to look for the version of Cleopatra they'd produced with Theda Bara. And they felt that all this needed was, quote, a little rewriting. Well, the fact it was a silent film might have suggested it needed a little more than that. It then began, it really began spiraling out of control when, Big was beautiful, as I say, back in those days. They wanted a big, spectacular movie. And the biggest female star at that moment was Elizabeth Taylor. And legend has it she was then married to Eddie Fisher, and the singer. And she was in the bath or the shower, and he said, "Oh, 20th Century Fox on the phone. They wanted to play Cleopatra," and she airily said, "Oh, well, I don't want to do it. I'll do it for $1 million." And they said yes, and nobody had ever been ever no actor actress had ever been paid that sum of money for one role. So that's when it started going horribly wrong.
From the get-go, almost, and I didn't realize until I was reading your book that Joan Collins was the original choice of Cleopatra, and Richard Burton was not the original choice for Mark Anthony.
Mark Anthony, no, Burton, his film career, he was, I mean, there's three Richard Burtons, really. There's this Richie, he was born Richie Jenkins in extreme poverty in Wales during the Depression in the 1920s. He then went on to blitz the London stage in the immediate post-war period. He made Shakespeare sexy. Hollywood signed him up. He hadn't really. He was very successful in The Robe, one of those big biblical epics, but he hadn't really made much of an impact on Hollywood. So they were looking for somebody, and Stephen Boyd came on board because of his success in Ben-Hur. Peter Finch was going to play Julius Caesar. Now, you'd think he couldn't, nothing could go wrong, except that they decided to make this film set in the Mediterranean, the glories, recreating the glories of ancient Egypt, in the UK. Now, it may seem an odd choice that the ancient Egyptian capital of Alexandria was recreated on a 20-acre site at Pinewood Studios. The main reason was that there was a thing called the Edey Levy, and the government's, if there was a high percentage of British craftsmen employed in the film production, they got enormous tax breaks. So Hollywood thought, well, this is a really good idea. Let's do it there. So they built this incredibly lavish, let's say, 20-acre set. There's some fantastic stuff on YouTube about it. You thought, well, nothing. This is the original director, Ruben Mamoulian. They thought, well, this is okay. But I don't know if you're familiar with UK weather in the autumn. It tends not to be blue skies and sunny. Basically, if it wasn't raining, it was really misty. You couldn't see the other side of the set. The producer said, one day we called 500 extras, could hardly find them in the fog. Another day, rain, mud, slush. On a good day, whenever a word was spoken, you could see the vapour coming out of the actors' mouths. Mm-hmm. Palm trees had to be flown in on a daily basis because they were wilting. It's a complete catastrophe. The studio thought, well, what do we do? Now, the crunch came. They'd already spent, it's hard to get an actual figure, but I believe they'd already spent nearly $7 million to get to that stage. Now, this is 1960 prices. So, magnify that. I don't know. It was folly on a grand scale. Now, the crunch came. Did they bite the bullet? Did 20th Century Fox say, right, that's it? Wipe the slate clean, forget it, we're never going to do it. Oh, in the middle of all that, sorry, I should also mention, Elizabeth Taylor had never suffered the best of health. She had a couple of life-threatening illnesses while they were filming in Pinewood Studios, and I believe there's no actual footage of her in the English footage at all. There's some long shots of Peter Finch as Caesar, but you wouldn't recognise him. They managed to get less than 6 minutes of film. So you're talking about $1 million a minute at that stage. So the studio, they came to the crunch was, do we just cut our losses and wipe it off the slate, or do we come up with an alternative? Well, the alternative was, let's go somewhere where there's sunshine. So they went to Italy. What else could possibly go wrong? ...
In a word, everything,
the thing is, I think I said in the book, I mean, the actual making of Cleopatra, to my mind, is a far better story than the film itself. They got to Rome. The Olympics had just been held there. Accommodation was at a premium. They started building these elaborate sets. Ruben Mamoulian left the picture. Joseph Mankiewicz came on board. Elizabeth Taylor had casting approval. She'd got on very well with Mankiewicz when they were doing Suddenly Last Summer. He was not known, though, for a director of spectacle. He got Oscars for All About Eve and The Women. I mean, a terrifically talented writer and director, but for a film of this scale, he wasn't the ideal choice, but he was the one that Taylor wanted. To his eternal credit, he always envisaged the film as two films. He saw it as the first part would be Cleopatra's romance with Caesar, and the second film would be her relationship with Mark Antony. And how this would have worked out, nobody's entirely clear. Would they have been shown on alternate nights or even alternate years? But that was his plan. But of course, in the middle of all that, everything's not even going smoothly. Everything's going horribly wrong, even when they're in Rome. In the middle of all this, Burton arrives on the set, and I think it's fair to say that sparks flew between him and his leading lady. Both Taylor and Burton were married to other people. The affair that took place in Italy was literally front page news around the world. There's a story that one journalist was going to the White House to interview President Kennedy about the Bay of Pigs or the Cuban Missile Crisis. Nobody's entirely sure. But, I mean, world on the brink of nuclear war, and Jacqueline Kennedy took the journalist aside to say, do you think Richard Burton will leave his wife for Elizabeth Taylor? I mean, the world was just fascinated by this romance. So, of course, that didn't exactly make production go very smoothly. The set for the Roman Forum for the film of Cleopatra was twice the size of the original. The scale of it is I don't know if you've seen the film recently, Jim.
Not recently, no.
What they call the money shot is Cleopatra's entry to Rome on this Sphinx pulled by Nubian slaves, surrounded by extras, and you can see it on the in the trailer if you haven't got the energy for the 3.5 hour film. There is this incredible set. I mean, this vast set, somewhere between 10 and 20,000 extras. To this day, nobody's sure how many extras were actually in the scene, because they line up and they say, "Yes, I'd like to be an extra in Cleopatra," and they get their, be paid in lira or whatever. They'd run back to the end of the queue and sign up again. So, I mean, there were undeniably thousands of people. Now, you look at that scene and you think that those people had to be costumed, they had to be fed, they had to be accommodated. It relied on the weather. These days of CGI, where somebody sits at a computer and presses buttons to make it happen, this actually happened. I mean, it is a stunning scene. I mean, one of, it has to be said, one of many in the film, but it's not a great film. The ironically, the romance between Burton and Taylor on screen, which was literally occupying front pages around the world, is very tepid on screen. There's very little actual chemistry between them. The best thing in it is Rex Harrison as Julius Caesar. And I mean, beware the Ides of March, because when he goes, it starts to become actually quite a dull film. Given the scope and the scale of it, there was so much, everything just took so long to do. And the cast was called in from all over the world, some very good people in it. But George Cole, a very, very popular actor in the UK, he played Caesar's deaf mute slave. He was originally contracted for 14 weeks. He was there for 18 months
Wow.
and full salary. Richard O'Sullivan, who played the boy king, was there for I think almost a year, and he had it written into his contract that he could fly home every weekend to see Chelsea Football Club play. I mean, the money, it was just hemorrhaging money.
And not only the money and stuff, but also a couple of workers were killed setting up the Italian set when they ran when they came across an unexploded mine
Yeah,
or a bomb.
they were meant to have cleared the beach of mines. A couple of people were tragically killed. They were told that it was perfectly safe, and it wasn't. So
Not even.
they built Cleopatra's barge, life-size barge for $250,000. I mean, it's hardly in it for more than a few minutes. Somebody pointed out the items on Cleopatra's dressing table were made by Bulgari, and they're seen for mere seconds. Everything was top level, and money just had really seemed it seemed to be no objects at all. And I think part of the reason was, of course, we're now going back to the very early 1960s, so it's obviously pre-internet, it's pre-email, it's pre-fax. This is a long time ago. And of course, if the studio in Hollywood wanted to communicate with the location in Rome, it was, transatlantic cables or lengthy transatlantic phone calls, which took forever. Another thing Taylor insisted on was that her late husband Mike Todd had invented this formula called Todd AO, which is big screen, and she wanted the film shot in that, which meant that she would get some royalties from that. But there was no facility to process that in Rome, so the film had to go all the way to Los Angeles, be processed there, then come back to. How it ever got finished is almost a miracle.
Yeah, and to add insult to injury, Roddy McDowall, what most people believe he was robbed of an Academy Award nomination due to an unheard of clerical error, listing him as a lead actor instead of a supporting actor.
I mean, it couldn't have. I mean, it just couldn't have got any worse. I think actually, there's a great film, or at least a mini series, to be made in the making of Cleopatra. Because it is it's hubris and it's chaos on a massive scale. And I don't think it was the one film that single-handedly destroyed the old studio system. I mean, at the same time that Fox were shooting Cleopatra, MGM were doing Mutiny on the Bounty with Marlon Brando and Trevor Howard, and that came in, I think, at an estimated $30 million. Again, they were on location in Tahiti and getting, there's one legendary exchange to the production on Tahiti from Los Angeles. You know, please send news. Cost is staggering. The cable came back. So is the cast. It was just, you know, I think that was, it was a double body blow to Hollywood, that they felt that the bigger the stars, the bigger the productions, that they couldn't lose money.
And that's really, I mean, it may not have spelled the end of the studio system, but it started the ending of the big epic pictures.
Mm.
Because I think like around the same time, well, in a couple of years, it was The Sound of Music, which in your book say the only thing that saved Fox, 20th Century Fox, was that, the Sound of Music.
Yeah.
But there are other epic films like Greatest Story Ever Told.
Absolutely. That was one that apparently the most expensive film shot on American soil. Again, that died. There was that maverick producer, who I'm very fond of, Samuel Bronson, who did 55 Days at Peking and The Fall of the Roman Empire, these big, big films, which I think are fantastic. But again, the train had kind of left the station by then. You know, it was sort of those big, big screen epics. They just didn't seem to appeal. It was a younger demographic. You know, the end of when Cleopatra was premiered at the end of 1963, the Beatles had conquered the UK, were on their way to conquer the rest of the world. You know, there was this sort of shift in audiences, and they weren't. And of course, by the time Cleopatra came out, Elizabeth Taylor was I think only 31, but there was this new generation of stars like Judy Christie and Samantha Eggar and these young actresses who were not necessarily, you know, demonstrably younger than Taylor, but they seem to offer something fresh.
Yeah, it's a much younger genre, as I guess you could say, after the end of the big epic pictures. Two of them that come to mind is Lawrence of Arabia, which I think that did well, and Spartacus did well. But a lot of people say, well, Spartacus did well because of the controversy around it with Dalton Trumbo.
Yes, but it's also directed by I hesitate to use the word genius, but Stanley Kubrick, and you know, David Lean was no slouch when it came to Lawrence of Arabia either. And I mean, again, no criticism of Joe Mankiewicz and Cleopatra. I think had his original vision been pursued, it might be a far better film. Although I sense he wasn't great with the big crowd scenes, whereas Lean and Kubrick handled those magnificent, those films you mentioned.
Was that the last film that Mankiewicz directed?
No, he did one. He did a couple. He did one called The Honeypot with Rex Harrison, which wasn't bad. And one other one I can't remember. But he ended his career with Sleuth, which was a fantastic little film with Michael Caine and Laurence Olivier. But I mean, it was a film play. You know, there was no particular skill needed to do that. No, that really. And his kids went into movies, and I think they felt that Cleopatra had really broken their dad's
Now, and like you mentioned, the cost of the film, they didn't make the cost back, and this was a unique story too. They didn't make the cost back until it came on TV in 1973, and then they closed the books on it because they didn't want to pay the actors who had a percentage of the profits.
Yeah, it took a long. Well, as you know, I mean, the cost of a film, you then have to include reproducing sufficient reels to show it in cinemas, publicity, and marketing. I mean, the actual I can't remember the I think the actual cans of film to show Cleopatra were about 8 foot tall. I mean, you know, it was a hell of a thing to get, just to get it onto the screen. And of course, that's where the cuts began. Daryl Zanuck had taken over at 20th Century Fox, and you had Cleopatra hemorrhaging money. And his particular cherished project was The Longest Day, which was a hard sell. And apparently it was only at the board meeting, one of the 20th Century Fox board members had been, I think, a general in World War II, mm-hmm. and he knew all about the Normandy landing. So a lot of the American public, I believe, they didn't think there was a market for a film about Normandy and D-Day. And Zanuck proved them wrong, and, you know, Longest Day is a fantastic film. That helped 20th Century Fox. As you mentioned earlier, as did The Sound of Music. That really hauled them out of the depths. But yes, I mean, Cleopatra, it did eventually go into profit. One of the studio heads said, yes, it did go into profit, but he took the studio with it. You know, so.
You know, what got you interested in this movie?
Well, it's a personal thing, actually. I mean, I'm of an age that I would have been 11 when Cleopatra came out, and I just finished writing an article about the Guns of Navarone and seeing that at the cinema again. In the UK, you had two black and white television channels at the time. That was it. And so anything in colour you seized upon, anything that was big screen entertainment in stereo, you said, oh, this is fantastic. So I've got a great soft spot for those movies anyway. But we live in a part of London called Dulwich, and there was a pub my parents and I used to go to for big occasions. And rumour came back that the pub we went to, the Grove Tavern, Elizabeth Taylor was visiting there. And my mother, I remember, she couldn't believe. I mean, this is when, you know, this is obviously pre, you know, paparazzi, pre mobile mm-hmm. phones. The idea that this near divinity could be sitting where my mother had sat only you know hours before. I remember that very clearly. And there's a picture appeared in the local paper of Elizabeth Taylor looking rather grim and a Richard Burton looking as though he hadn't had his first drink of the day. They were actually there. And so that was sort of planted the seed. And then I was working on a monthly magazine here called Vox. And I did a piece, I was a films editor. I did a piece about the 30th anniversary of the film. So I'd done quite a lot of research on it. And then it came to me a couple of years ago that 60 years would be a good opportunity to write something in detail. I mean, unfortunately, none of the original cast. I think Jean Marsh and Richard O'Sullivan was still alive, but not well. So I couldn't do any interviews for it. But so much had been written about. I mean, I think I read 5 Elizabeth Taylor biographies. You know, so much had been written about her, and so much of her life was tied in with that film, because that's where she met Burton.
That's right. Yeah. So, well, the author's name is Patrick Humphreys. And the book is Cleopatra and the Undoing of Hollywood, How One Film Almost Sunk the Studios. It's out now, and it's on Amazon and also Amazon in the UK. Patrick, yep. I really want to thank you for being on Lights, Camera, Author today.
A pleasure. I'd like to end by saying that you'd like to think that the studios have learned their lesson, but when I was writing this book about this catastrophic 1963 production, Warner Brothers announced they pulled the plug on Catwoman.
A bad girl.
They put $100 million into it, and nobody's ever going to see it. So
Bad Girl. Yeah. You mean the movie Bad Girl?
Yeah. Oh, I'm so sorry. Yeah. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. They still haven't learned their lesson, have they?
You know, what do you have to do to learn? I think the other thing with Cleopatra was, you know, also the stars changing, but the younger audience were going to see things like The Graduate and Easy Rider, which, you know, the cost of them was what they spent on paper cups for Cleopatra. So.
Well, Patrick, again, thank you for being on Lights,
Camera,
Author.
Thank you, Jim.